Welcome to the Darrell McClain Show. I'm your host, Darrell McClain, and let's get into our episode.
Simply search for the T-Bone and Chick Brew podcast, available wherever fine podcasts are sold.
The Darrell McClain Show is fully listener-supported, independent media that won't lead you to tribalism. You can get a membership for as little as $3 a month at www.patreon.com/TheDarrellMcClain Show.
We talk about a lot of serious topics on this show. One very serious topic is women's health. One company that stood out to me was VSlay.com because the owner is very transparent about her own struggles in the women's health department and has great customer service, great deals, and frequent sales. You can check her out, her great customer service, products about women's health, and frequent sales at www.VSlay.com. That is www.VSlay.com. If a man doesn't have a job or income, he has neither life nor liberty, nor the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists. Welcome to the show. Our quote today comes from the late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I picked this quote in particular because on the Martin Luther King Day celebration, I knew that the thing that was going to happen, that has been happening for the past 50 or so years, was going to continue to happen, which is where you take somebody's lifelong legacy and work, and they have so sanitized and watered it down that they have taken the legacy of Dr. King, the good and the complicated, and made it into one line giving on one speech on one particular day. I want my children to be judged by the content of the character, not the color of their skin. And I have labored under the assumption for a very long time that it is about time for us to get to the rest of the legacy, to get to the where do we go from here part of that. So this is going to be a big news week, and got a lot of stuff going on as far as the horse race politics, a bit of a Cold War heating up a bit between President Donald Trump and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. And not as well as he got a Democratic operative by the name of Paul Begala, Bill Clinton guy, somebody who used to be smart enough back in the James Carville days to understand that it was the economy, stupid. So it was the economic impact of people that were deciding their voting decisions, who now believes that is no longer the case. The problem is not income inequality. The problem is not people being stuck in their house during COVID. The problem is not people being afraid of whether they're sending their children to school and debating whether to do it or not to do it, whether they should wear masks or not wear masks, whether they should be vaccinated or unvaccinated. It's not inflation it's not the supply chain demand. No, no, no. The problem is the voters. Paul Begala believes that the problem with Joe Biden is not that they are not delivering for the people. The problem is they just don't have good followers. So I'm going to get a bit into that as well. As well as some stuff that has come out of the courts, the local attorney general's offices, as well as, well, that would be the Justice Department, but the Supreme Court decisions that have come out this week as well. And people who like to say they back certain legacies and believe in certain things, and when it's their time to put that proof into something substantive, into something concrete, they fail to do it. And of course, I'm talking about Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin. You know, start off a bit though, going down this economic path, staying on this path by talking about some of the workers from Kroger. I want us to keep in mind that, you know, the Kroger people and the people who worked throughout the pandemic, very fast they switched from being essential personnel to, you know, essential, you know, we need them, that's how they we function, etc., to being back to being unskilled labor just in a matter of weeks. Went from being essential to unskilled. A new survey of 10,000 Kroger supermarket workers reveal that 2 of 3 employees are living in poverty and struggling to survive. The grocery company's CEO made $20 million in 2021. Meanwhile, 40% of workers can't afford food and 14% have been homeless in the last year. So, let me just say that last point again. The grocery company's CEO made $20 million in 2021. Meanwhile, 40% of the workers can't afford food, and 14% have been homeless last year. So let's take a listen to one of the workers talking about the conditions that they have been going through, not just the uncaring nature of them having to work or servicing the public by working throughout the entire pandemic, but the disrespect that they have to suffer while doing so. Let's take a listen.
I'm William Valdez, King Soopers 119 Meat Market Manager. I'm sitting in negotiations on 114-22. We just concluded a meeting that lasted 15 minutes with Kroger representatives. Mr. John McPherson, the head of labor relations for Kroger, stated, "Let your people stay on the street." That's what he thinks about us, and that's what he thinks about you. And that's the value that they have in the people that work for them. So that's why we are on strike.
White, privileged old men. No diversity, no women. That's what's making these proposals. These people wouldn't be able to make it on what they're trying to pay us.
I worked for this company for almost 42 years. I love my job. I love my company. But Joe Kelly is not a person of our company. If he can come in here and yell at us and be disrespectful to us, this is not our company anymore, you know? We're just trying to give us a fair wage and what's fair for everybody. The contract has to be include every single person in our company, not just a few people can benefit from this. And this is not fair, and this is not respectful, faithful negotiating.
And they had completely denied all of our proposals. They wouldn't even look at it.
Been with King Soopers for 9 years, watching what happened today, and very disappointed in our company. This is a company I was proud to work for, and now I feel like they really don't care about us.
Oh,
that woman worked at Kroger for that long, that's just flat out amazing to me. That is a long lineage, a long period to be particularly dedicated to one company. And when you go to your employer, as every person has the right to do, and demand or ask something more of them, you think that the response for your labor would be at least a good faith back and forth about what can be done with your request. But them asking for what they asked for in their proposal, say they weren't even looked at. They were ignored, marginalized, and disrespected. How far have we gone from the days where people who kept the lines going and kept the stores open during the pandemic were heroes? We were calling them heroes all last year. Existential heroes, the backbone of the economy. But now, when it is time for us to pay for that heroship, Kroger is not interested. Not interested at all. Let me tell you something. The only way these people are going to get what they want out of Starbucks, the only way anybody is going to get what they want out of any of these multinational corporations who have bought whole line and cloth, the political elites that are supposed to represent you, the only way you're going to get anything is to, you have to unionize. There has to be more power in the workers. It's exactly what is happening now at Starbucks. And Starbucks they have a Bernie Sanders problem. Let's just put it that way. And taking on Starbucks has actually been expired by Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont. The liberal workers, the company has long attracted an expanding union campaign to other cities after a landmark victory in Buffalo. So, Maggie Carter, a Starbucks barista in Knoxville, Tennessee, is a warm and reassuring presence who says she is keen to go the extra mile for the customers. She may also be a nightmare for Starbucks executives, as a union organizing campaign that began in Buffalo and produced the company's only two unionized U.S. stores spreads to other cities. It is the beginning and driven by workers like Ms. Carter's, who is young, well-educated, and happens to be also politically very liberal. Now, Ms. Carter, who began circulating union cards at her store not long after results of the Buffalo's election were announced last month, studies broadcast journalism at the University of Tennessee. She is passionate about climate change, fighting racism, and labor rights. After her political hero is Senator Bernie Sanders, the Vermont Independent. "Bernie Sanders is my everything," Ms. Carter says. "I love him more than anything." Perhaps more disconcertingly for Starbucks, as it tries to contain Ms. Carter's union campaign, Ms. Carter appears to be representative of the kind of people the company has hired over the years to reinforce Starbucks' progressive branding. Now, labor experts say that in seeking such employees, Starbucks may have built a workforce that is more inclined to unionize and to be energized by the Buffalo campaign. Quote, "If you think about the kinds of employees they have, the stereotype of people that work there seems to be true. A lot of young people, Bernie supporters, Democratic Socialists of America types, said John Logan, a labor studies professor at San Francisco State University, referring to Democratic Socialists of America. These are the kinds of people who can take this and run with it. It could be in Knoxville in Arizona just as easily as in San Francisco and Manhattan. A Starbucks spokesman, Reggie Boards, said the company was not anti-union, but pro-partner, and refers to employees that it has historically made changes in response to input from workers, making a union unnecessary. Now, with more than 230,000 employees at roughly 9,000 companies operating stores across the country, Starbucks employs plenty of older workers, conservative-leaning workers, and those with high school diplomas or less. Some who were heavily involved in the Buffalo campaign had never even been to college. But at least compared with other food and retail establishments, Starbucks customers tend to be liberal, well-educated, and the company's hiring appears to reflect those demographics as well. The company's annual report plays up its employees as significant contributors to our success as a global brand that leads with purpose. Now, Starbucks allows employees who work at least 20 hours a week to obtain health coverage, more generous than most competitors, as it has said, and it will increase the average hourly pay to employees to nearly $17 an hour by the summer, well above the industry norm. The company also offers to pay the tuition of employees admitted to pursue an online bachelor's degree at Arizona State University, helping to attract workers with college aspirations. Now, such people in turn tend to be sympathetic to unions and a variety of social activism. A recent Gallup poll found that the people under 35 or who are liberal are substantially more likely than others to support unions. Several Starbucks workers seeking to organize unions in Buffalo, Boston, Chicago, Seattle, Knoxville, Tennessee, Tallahassee, Florida, and the Denver area appear to fit this profile, saying they were either strong supporters of Bernie Sanders and other progressive politicians and had attended college or both. Most were under 30. Quote, I have been involved in political organizing the Bernie Sanders campaign, said Brick Zurich, a leader of a union campaign at a Starbucks in Chicago. That gave me a lot of skill. MX Zurich, who uses gender-neutral courtesies, titles, and pronouns, also said that they had a bachelor's degree. Lynn Harris, who has helped lead a campaign at Starbucks near Denver, said that I admire the progressivism, the sense of community. Now, they admire politicians like Bernie Sanders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the Democratic congresswoman from New York. She said that she graduated from college and that she is awaiting admission decision for graduate school. And most union supporters have drawn inspiration from their colleagues in Buffalo. Sydney Durkin and Rachel Yarborough, who are helping to organize Starbucks in Seattle, said workers at their store discussed the Buffalo campaign almost daily as it unfolded. And that one reached out to the union after the National Labor Relations Board announced the initial results of the Buffalo election in December. The union's second victory was announced Monday after the Labor Board resolved the ballot challenges. Now, Ms. Yarbrough said the victory showed workers it was possible to unionize despite company opposition. The Buffalo folks became superheroes, she said. A lot of us spent so much time being afraid of retaliation, none of us could afford to lose our jobs or have our hours cut. Since three Buffalo area stores have now filed for union elections in late August, workers have filed for elections in at least 15 Starbucks stores nationwide. At least 10 of the filings came after the union victory in Buffalo. It's the day the Buffalo announced they have won the union that I said, I'm going to try to unionize my store, Ms. Harris recalled. Mr. Logan, the labor studies professor, said the pattern might be the turning of the conventional wisdom and labor and organizing on its head. Unions have traditionally
prefer to aim at companies with relatively small number of large workplaces because unionizing these sites creates economic leverage. Striking at of a dozen large factories can disrupt the company's operations, while striking at out of 9,000 stores makes no difference to the company's bottom line. But over the past few decades, victories at large, high-profile job sites have been less common. Unions have lost elections at Boeing, Nissan, Volkswagen, Amazon facilities through the labor board letter overturned the Amazon results and called for a new election. The Starbucks campaign shows that focusing on small workplaces at a high-profile company may be more effective because a victory can build momentum nationwide. Quote, in terms of creating a momentum for unions, if you organize 100 stores, it would be the biggest thing that happened in 50 years, Mr. Logan said. Even if the direct economic impact on Starbucks is minor, he added, the media attention and political pressure on the companies could be enormous. So Richard Berzinger, who oversees Starbucks organizing for the union representing its employees, Workers United, said in an interview that the goal of the campaign was to build support among workers nationally, to rally public opinion, and ultimately to pressure the company to stay neutral so that any stores whose employees wanted a union could easily get one. So the real question is getting the country to stand up for David, not Goliath, Mr. Berzinger said. Every day, we're getting more people. It's getting stronger. Further benefiting the union are the economics of organizing workers versus the economics of persuading workers not to unionize. The cost of seeking an election at another store, like legal filings whose arguments the union's lawyers have already refined, are relatively modest. Starbucks workers themselves are on the boots, and they are the boots that are on the ground. By contrast, if a company were to replicate its Buffalo approach, that could mean bringing in 10 or more out-of-town officials over a period of months. Starbucks has dispatched few out-of-town officials, area managers, to store in Arizona, the only city beyond Buffalo where the labor board has set an election date. The company said that some officials there were addressing operational issues and others were educating employees about what unionizing could entail. As in Buffalo, some workers in both cities found the presence of these officials intimidating. Now, Starbucks has no shortage of cards to play resisting unionization, while companies must bargain in good faith with the NLRB certified unions. They are not required to agree to a contract, and negotiations could drag on for years. The company can also afford to spend large sums to discourage union organizing. But the image of a conscious company could eventually decide that the risk of an anti-union representation is a costlier than a more accommodating posture. You don't want to antagonize your customer base, said Stephen M. Swirsky, a management side lawyer at Epstein, Baker, and Green. They have created a brand with certain mystiques around it. You have to be sensitive to how to maintain that, not undermine it. Starbucks may also conclude that what they want is spends opposing unions is not money well spent. When you're making a resource commitment, at some point you have to realize there's a reason this is happening, and it may not be the reason you're going to be able to fix soon enough to make the difference, said Brian West Easley, a management side lawyer at Jones Day. So complicating the challenge is that workers involved in organizing appear to be less interested in addressing specific problems like staffing and pay, though those are certainly concerns, than in having more input at work, David Presblisk said, a management side lawyer at Barnes and Thorburn, said that over 100 campaigns he has handled, the union typically failed to even qualify for a vote when there were specific economic issues driving the organization, but tended to get much further when employees don't feel like they have a voice. Several Starbucks workers said that unionizing was not merely a means to improve their work lives, but a goal in itself that they supported as a union as a matter of principle. One of the main things we want to have a union for is to establish the right to have a union. It's a little circular, said Ms. Yarborough in Seattle. They are trying to discourage folks from creating any communal organization. That's the name of the game. Power does not concede anything without a fight. It just won't. And there is a lot of anti-union sentiment that has been growing in this country for a long time. It has partially been harbored and nurtured by the very sophisticated propaganda models that have people very afraid of their employers. And they're very afraid to say no when an employer is asking them to do something. They're very afraid to say no when they're called in on their day off. And they're very afraid to ask for better benefit packages, if any benefit package at all. And they're afraid to ask for wages. And they're afraid to say, I don't think I'm being treated with dignity and respect. But one thing the pandemic has done has empowered a lot of people with the ability to say no, and they feel a lot more comfort doing that than they used to. They call it the Great Resignation. Even when unemployment benefits started to be slimmed back on large scales, people still said, hell no, I will not go. Some people decided they wouldn't go back to work, period. Some people decided it was time to pick a new profession. Some people said, you know what? I've worked here several years. I've been in the labor force for several years. It is time for me to call it quits and retire. So that has given people a bit of bargaining leverage, to say. The time of the worker is coming back. And I think this is one of the only real movements that we have at the moment, because politicians are not going to save us. The Democrats and the Republicans, I said it before, have abandoned all parliamentary principles. They are not interested in legislating. They're just not interested. I'm going to read an article from the Republican governor, ex-Republican governor George Sununu, who was offered a Senate run. I'm going to let you hear him in his own words about why he chose not to be in the Senate, even though, as a former governor, Sununu would have been almost a shoo-in to be a senator. And here is the hint. It's what John McCain said before he died. They are not getting anything done. And what Sununu says in this article is, that's actually the plan. These people don't want to get anything done, and that's just not what he does.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
It goes without saying that this show does not happen without listener support. Support the Darrell McClain Show by going to www.patreon.com and getting a membership for $3. Or you can go to buzzsprouts.com/Darrell McClain Show. And hit the subscribe button and join there. Many ways to donate to the show. Independent media that won't reinforce tribalism. We have one planet. Nobody is leaving. So let us reason together. www.patreon.com/Darrell McClain Show. Or go to Buzzsprouts and to the Darrell McClain Show and subscribe.
Senate Republicans harboring visions of securing the majority in next year's midterms suffered a blow Tuesday when perhaps their most valuable potential recruit, New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu, said he would not challenge Senator Maggie Hassan. But a year before Election Day, both Republicans and Democrats have reason to cling to optimism and harbor deep doubts about their chances of claiming control of the U.S. Senate. The GOP path to a majority will not be smooth, and the Democratic bulwarks are not fully fortified, and a challenging year lies ahead for both parties.
So, the New Hampshire governor, Chris Sununu, Republican, said in an interview he had passed on running for Senate because he didn't want to simply be a robot to President Biden for 2 years. Quote, I was pretty close, Sununu told the Washington Examiner, about winning a Senate bid. I wasn't ready to make an announcement, but I was like, okay, this makes sense. I think I could be a voice nationally. Sununu, who Republicans were hoping to see run for the Senate in the Granite State, explained he decided instead to run for re-election for governor after hearing the party's plan for the Senate for the next 2 years. Quote, they were all, for the most part, content with the speed at which they weren't doing anything. It was very clear that we just have to hold the line for the next 2 years. Okay, so I'm just going to be a roadblock for the next 2 years? That's not what I do, Sununu said, noting Republicans were trying to wait until they would hopefully win the presidency in 2024. It bothered me the way they were okay with that, Sununu said. Sununu said he challenged the Republicans he were meeting with, asking them why the party didn't take larger steps to advance the agenda when Republicans controlled the Congress, the Senate, and the White House. I said, okay, so if we're going to be going to get stuff done if we win the White House, why didn't you do that in 2017 and 2018, Sununu asked, saying there were crickets. Yeah, crickets. And that they had no answer. Sununu stuck a similar tone in his speech announcing he would not run for Senate, saying he didn't want to run because he didn't want to be debating partisan politics without results. Many Republicans were frustrated when Sununu opted not to run for Senate, with GOP leaders in Washington reportedly disappointed that the governor didn't tell them about his decision before announcing it to the people. I don't work for them. I work for my citizens, Sununu told the Examiner. I think that would be insulting to the people in Washington if the people in Washington knew what I was doing before I gave the respect to the citizens who have hired me to do the job. So that is what we have been saying on the Daryl McClain Show for a long time, is that is the game. A lot of the legislators do not actually want to legislate. They have figured out they can forego legislation by just giving speeches after speech after speech, partisan red meat thrown to the base, when they actually don't want to pass any public policy. And look, I hate to tell you folks, it is primarily the same when it comes to Democrats as it is with Republicans. When Democrats are in power, they're not particularly interested in doing mainstream big legislation either. And this is a very simple answer to why both of these parties don't want to do actual legislation. That's why presidents just go to war willy-nilly without Congress actually declaring a war, voting on it anymore. And it's because the donors aren't interested in a lot of these policies that the populace wants. 60% of people want this. 78% want that. 92% want this. 85% want that. You go to opensecrets.org. You look at who are funding particular politicians. And then you follow their voting record. And it almost all the time lines up exactly with what the donors want and not what the people want. Democrats right now are saying they cannot get anything done because two Democrats in the Senate, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, won't vote with them. 50 Democrats. Democrats control the House. Democrats control the Senate. Democrats control the presidency. And they won't do the common sense thing, which, look, I'll tell you what the common sense thing is. If Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema say that they are agreeing on certain aspects of Build Back Better, if they say that they want to pass voting rights legislation, what you do is very simple. You make Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema write the legislation that they would vote for, and then the other 48 Democrats join the two holdouts and they vote for that bill. But that's not what has been happening. Democrats, 48 of them, are saying that they can't get anything done because they can't bring the two Democrats to heel. And look, Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin just may be very disingenuous people who are have no shame. But we knew that 365 days ago. We knew it in the first 6 months. To be honest, Joe Manchin has been all over the place. Joe Manchin came out at one time saying he'd be comfortable with these trillions of dollars of bills. And then it was 6 trillion and 4. Got broken down to 4 trillion, 3 trillion, then 1 point something trillion. And then, because he wasn't really on with the social infrastructure plan, so they did that thing that everybody knew was going to get them off the hook. They split the bills, split the normal infrastructure bill from the social infrastructure bill. The social infrastructure bill languishes sitting there, not getting passed, and the infrastructure bill, because it was a massive handout to corporations, passes with bipartisan flying colors. Of course it was, because the donors wanted it. It was about what they wanted, not what the people wanted. So what you have to do is singly split the Build Back Better bill up. You send it to Joe Manchin. You send it to Kyrsten Sinema. You say, we have 3 more years in charge. What are you actually going to vote for? You write the legislation, and then the Democrats vote on it. The Republicans are already not going to vote for anything Democrats want. Now, yeah, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, oh, yeah, they'll vote for Republicans. Because in their particular states, they get something for voting with Republicans. Joe Manchin won West Virginia. Well, Donald Trump won West Virginia. Joe Manchin gets points in West Virginia for being seen as sticking his finger in the nose of Democrats. That is a game that he has to play. Whether we like it or not, that's a game he has to play. Kyrsten Sinema, ran on a lot of things and materially it now seems against all those things. And that's where I'm going to go at next, with Kyrsten Sinema not saying she is going to do a lot of these things with voting, etc., because principally she disagrees with the partisan nature of the way bills are being passed. I don't know why politicians say they disagree with the partisan natures of anything, unless you're the person, the few people sitting in the Congress and the Senate who carry the title of independents. And I think that's Angus King and Bernie Sanders. You know, if there are other people sitting around in the Congress and the Senate who won't join the Republican and Democratic Party, please let me know. But Kyrsten Sinema's speech on voting rights, the stunning thing she did, and then what happened last night while a lot of us were sleeping, we're going to go over that as well.
Senate speeches for decades now, most of them while I was sitting in the Senate chamber as a Democratic Senate staff member. And I have never heard a more contemptuous speech by a Democratic senator than the one written by Kyrsten Sinema's Senate staff and read by Senator Sinema on the Senate floor today. The speech was filled with contempt for Senator Sinema's Democratic colleagues, for her constituents, and for all of you. Senator Sinema expressed that contempt by delivering a nonstop insult to the intelligence of everyone who was listening. She filled her 20 minutes on the Senate floor with a string of Hallmark greeting card-like platitudes about how the United States Senate should work, and not a single word about the reality of why the United States Senate no longer works. in announcing her opposition to changing Senate rules in any way in order to pass voting rights legislation by a simple majority vote. Senator Sinema said this.
Eliminating the 60-vote threshold will simply guarantee that we lose a critical tool that we need to safeguard our democracy from threats in the years to come.
It is hard to think of a stupider thing that could be said about the 60-vote threshold. That was Senator Sinema claiming that the 60-vote rule in the Senate is, quote, a critical tool that we need to safeguard our democracy. It is, in fact, the single most anti-democracy rule that exists in American government. If Senator Sinema said a single true thing about the 60-vote rule today, I would press the play button for that right now and let you hear it. She didn't. Not one true word about the 60-vote rule. So here is something untrue that Senator Sinema said about her own history with the 60-vote threshold.
There's no need for me to restate my long-standing support for the 60-vote threshold to pass legislation. There's no need for me to restate its role protecting our country from wild reversals in federal policy.
My long-standing support for the 60-vote threshold to pass legislation. Here is Kyrsten Sinema in 2010 discussing the 60-vote threshold while she mocks a Democratic senator for being insufficiently loyal to the Democratic Party.
Well, in the Senate, we no longer have 60 votes. Some would argue we never had 60 because one of those was Joseph Lieberman. But that's whatever. Yeah, and Nelson too, but Lieberman. So now there's, I think as the president so eloquently said on Wednesday, there's none of this pressure, this false pressure to get to 60. So what that means is that the Democrats can stop kowtowing to Joe Lieberman and instead seek other avenues to move forward with health reform. And so it's likely that the Senate will move forward with a process called reconciliation, which takes only 51 votes. And by the way, it's not unusual. You may recall that before the Democrats took the Senate in 2008, that the Republicans controlled the Senate for quite some time. In fact, since around 1994, they never had 60 votes, and they managed to do a lot of really bad things during that time. So the reconciliation process is still quite available, and we will use it for good rather than for evil.
One of the differences about that speech is that no one wrote that for her. She wasn't reading that. So maybe that means that's what she actually thought. That version of Kyrsten Sinema, before she came to Washington, wanted to use the simple majority vote in the United States Senate for good instead of evil. She said the Republicans never got 60 votes. She didn't say that as a complaint. She said that admiring the Republican tactical ability to pass legislation without having to get 60 votes. We cannot know what Kyrsten Sinema actually believes or if she actually believes anything at all. But we do know that she did not support her position today with logic, intelligence, or truth. Senator Sinema did tell us how she feels about the unanimous opposition to voting rights legislation by every Republican in the United States Senate.
I share the disappointment of many that we've not found more support on the other side of the aisle for legislative responses to state-level voting restrictions. I wish that were not the case.
Disappointed. She's disappointed in Republicans. When Kyrsten Sinema ran for the United States Senate, she did not say that she would bring all of her legislative and policy goals in the United States Senate to the Republican leader of the Senate and try to get Republican approval of her agenda. That's not what she told Arizona voters, but that is her position now. Republicans have to approve everything Kyrsten Sinema wants to do, or she won't even try to do it. She will just stand at her desk in the United States Senate and be disappointed. And she will give up. If Republicans don't want to do what she wants to do, she will give up. That's what she's saying today. President Joe Biden said today he is not giving up. President Biden attended the Democratic Senator's luncheon today, where it is reported that Kyrsten Sinema sat looking at her phone for most of the time. Senator Sinema's speech on the Senate floor before the luncheon did not dissuade Senator John Ossoff from delivering a passionate talk during that lunch about changing the Senate rules, and that speech received a standing ovation in that room. After the meeting with the Democratic senators, President Biden said this: I hope we can get this done. The honest to God answer is, I don't know whether we can get this done. Like every other major civil rights bill that came along, if we miss the first time, we can come back and try it a second time. We miss this time, as long as I have a breath in me, as long as I'm in the White House, as long as I'm engaged at all, I'm going to be fighting to change the way these legislatures have moved.
So no need to play coy about it. The Democrats did not get it done. The Senate voted last night, 48-52, against a talking filibuster for the voting rights, which Manchin and Sinema joining all Republicans. The Freedom to Vote John R. Lewis Act has officially died in the Senate. Now, while Senator Manchin and Sinema continue to work with the Republicans to block federal voting protections, Republican officials last night met in Lincoln County, Georgia, to vote on their plan to close 6 out of 7 polling places in the county. So Republicans are doing everything they can to stop Democrats from voting. 243 laws have been proposed since the election of 2020. And Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin are saying there is nothing we can do but let them do what they're doing. State after state after state, there's nothing we can do. She's blaming, or claiming she won't do anything because, you know, I don't want to add to partisanship or whatever the heck. And I just say, if you are a United States Senator, if you're not doing everything in your power to protect the fundamental rights as Americans, you have lost the plot. And I just want everybody to remember that Judge Amy Coney Barrett, Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett, Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch, every single Republican voted to nuke the filibuster to confirm all three of those Supreme Court justices. All of a sudden, they didn't need the supermajority. They didn't need 60 votes. They just needed 51. They just needed a simple majority. Republicans had no problem changing the rules of the filibuster to confirm Supreme Court justices, but Democrats won't do the same thing to protect the right to vote. This is crazy. Tammy Duckworth, you know, last night didn't go without its theatrics. Tammy Duckworth called Republicans out for filibustering the Voting Rights Act, saying, "You are asking paid staffers to bring you water at exactly the exact temperature while you are speaking, and it's sparkling or not, but you're doing nothing to stop a law that makes it illegal to give water to voters at the polls." Senator John Ossoff shut down the Republicans on the Senate floor and said, "I speak for the state of Georgia when I say do not invoke Congressman John Lewis' names to signal your virtue while you work to erode his legacy and defy his will." Senator Warnock, "You cannot remember MLK and dismember his legacy at the same time. I will not sit quietly, said the other senator from Georgia, Senator Raphael Warnock. The Senator Warnock is actually the pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, where Martin Luther King Jr. was the pastor from 1960 until the day he was murdered.
But it takes 60 votes to repair the ceiling of our democracy by passing voting rights legislation. I'm left to conclude that if the issue is important enough, the Senate feels compelled to act. Well, let me say that I believe that the democracy is at least as important as the economy. Recently, many of our colleagues have argued that legislation to protect voting rights somehow offends our federal system of government and amounts, they say, to a federal takeover of elections. Some of the same voices, ironically, who have extolled Dr. King's life this week have at the same time been working vigorously against the legislation we're debating today to protect the right to vote. And many of them have been channeling old states' rights arguments. Let the message go out. You cannot remember Martin Luther King Jr. and dismember his legacy at the same time. You can argue whatever side you want, but you do not get to argue both sides. I will not sit quietly while some make Dr. King a victim of identity theft. You do not get to offer praises and plaudits in memory of Dr. King and then marshal the same kinds of states' rights arguments that were used against Dr. King and against the civil rights movement. Please know that as the pastor of Dr. King's church, this argument evokes, I say really respectfully, it evokes some of the darkest moments in our country's long struggle for equality. And he said, Church, this argument evokes, I say really respectfully, it evokes some of the darkest moments in our country's long struggle for equality. And he said, history has thrust something upon me from which I cannot turn away. Those of us who are students of Dr. King, I know I have often wondered, what would I have done if I were alive during the civil rights movement? I know we would all like to think that we too would have had just a small fraction, just a fraction of the courage that it took for John Lewis to cross that Edmund Pettus Bridge. Well, for those of us who are fortunate enough to serve in the United States Senate in this moral moment, we do not have to wonder. My God, he faced troopers on the other side crossing that bridge. We're talking about a procedural bridge. We don't have to wonder what we would have done. I submit that what we would have done back then, we are doing right now. History is watching us. Our children are counting on us. And I hope that we will have the courage to do what is right for our communities and for our country. The courage to cross this bridge, to do the hard work in this defining moral moment in America for the sake of the communities that sent us here in the first place, for the sake of the planet, for the sake of healthcare, for the sake of jobs, for the sake of being able to argue for the things that we care about. The courage to fight for one another. I'm still praying that we will cross that bridge. But if not tonight, we will come back again and again and again. Madam Vice President, I yield the floor.
Don't lecture me about Jim Crow. I know this is not 1965. That's what makes me so outraged. It's 2022. and they're blatantly removing more polling places from the counties where Black and Latinos are overrepresented. I'm not making that up. That is a fact. I'm not going to stop because I'm tired of hearing that this does not have to do about singling out certain populations in our country, students, Native Americans, and not others. I'm not accusing anybody. Please, let's not throw around the defense where we crouch into defensive postures. I'm not accusing anybody of being racist. I'm just speaking to the facts in our country that I know motivate everybody here.
So that was Senator Raphael Warnock and Senator Cory Booker. So let me just say one thing right off the bat. So Senator Cory Booker will say, I'm not accusing anybody of anything. And that's just something he has to do in the Senate. I'm accusing everybody of exactly what they're doing. You do not craft 253 laws to do a thing while pretending you're not doing it. The entire thing about public policy is if you're crafting a policy, you're doing it to affect a certain sliver of the public. So, if these policies are narrowly targeted in such a way that it only hurts and affects a certain group of the population, then I assume you are doing exactly what you targeted, what you intended to do. Now, when it comes to Kristen Sinema saying John Lewis is her hero, which is obviously not true, when it comes to her quoting Martin Luther King on Twitter, blah, 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 and Rand Paul did the same thing and all these hypocrites, well, that's just par for the course. They have already taken that legacy. Like I said earlier, they have taken that legacy and made it nothing more than that one quote that we say, that everybody says all the time. I want to be judged by the content of the character, not the color of the skin. Right? But here's another quote that is not widely known from Martin Luther King. There comes a time when silence is betrayal. And that's from Martin Luther King Jr. as well. Here's another Martin Luther King quote that is more direct to this particular matter. The tragedy is that we have a Congress with a Senate that has a minority of misguided senators who will use the filibuster to keep the majority of the people from even voting. That was said by Martin Luther King Jr. in 1963, and here we stand in 2022. And you have the tragedy of the Congress and the Senate that a misguided minority is again using the will of the filibuster to keep the majority of the people from voting. As much as things change, they stay the same. They stay so much the same that I can go pull a quote from 1963 and it fit what the Senate just did yesterday. It's very rare that I do this, but I'll just say this. Anytime you hear somebody who is talking about the virtue and the legacy of a person who has passed away, and that person was signally known almost for one thing, it's very easy to go back and see where they would have stood on certain positions, especially because they gave speeches and did a lot of writings about this said issues. When people do not follow that legacy, do not hold up to those principles and practices, but still, without shame, invoke them all the time, I want you to remember the verse of the Bible, Matthew 15:8. And just remember that simple sentence where Jesus says, these people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. And that is what this is. These people honor the legacy of John Lewis and everything that those beatings he took for the right to vote, etc. They'll post pictures with him. Went to Georgia on the anniversary of his death and marched across the bridge and then sat right in the Senate and voted against the very legislation named after him to refix what the Supreme Court had undone. And when the Supreme Court undid that Voting Rights Act because they said it was outdated, it was no longer needed, they said that the Congress and the Senate are supposed to update the laws, and the Congress and the Senate has yet to get it done. Obviously, the Congress passed the bill, and it went to the Senate to die. The Supreme Court gutted it because they fundamentally didn't believe in it in the first place. That is what happened when those justices got put on those courts. They gutted, ripped to shreds Martin Luther King's signature piece of legislation, what he has known the most for. They gutted it and then went out on MLK Day and talked about how they wanted to be judged by the content of their character and not the color of their skin, where their character is bad because they honor you with their lips, but their hearts are wicked and far away from you. I want to make something clear about my thoughts about the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King and where it lines up today. Martin Luther King, when he passed away, his polls, he was deeply unpopular. He had been disinvited from the White House because he had come out against the war in Vietnam. Many of the black leaders of the time who were pro-Vietnam, were pro-war, and came out against Dr. King. He was killed. His mother was killed. His brother was killed. And then after the fact, now everybody pretends like they were down with the things that he was saying. If you go look at the things that J. Edgar Hoover was saying about Martin Luther King, he was extremely paranoid about there being a black messiah that would cause some type of revolution and a rising up amongst black people. I am thoroughly convinced if MLK were alive today, Democrats would be blaming him for low approval ratings of the current president. And if they lost the election, they would blame him for that. And Republicans would be doing the exact same thing that they do when anybody like that comes along. They would call him a socialist, a Marxist, a communist, and eventually a terrorist. Let's not pretend like we don't know what people actually believe and what they do. You want to be judged by the content of your character. Your character says you sell out your constituents anytime your donors tell you to do so. Your character says you don't represent the people. Your character says the love of money has so corrupted you that you cannot even fathom doing what is right versus what is easy. Your character shows that people like Tim Scott, Susan Collins, and Rob Portman traveled to Selma with John Lewis on the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, but still got on the Senate floor and filibuster the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. That is your character. I'm not so sure you want me to judge you by that. I'm not so sure you want to be judged about anything, because you don't want your character in that judgment seat, especially if you're going to keep pretending like you supported some of these people's legacies who shoes were very hard to fill. So I'm done with that and the fake posturing about these people who keep saying they so badly want to pass these bills but seem to never be able to get anything done. But let me see what Paul Begala has to say about why things don't happen. I'm somewhat tired of talking about myself right now. I kind of fired up about the disingenuousness of round voting and voting rights and everything that I'm hearing and the long way I look at voting and history. And I've always said, if anybody's trying to stop you from doing something, it's because they obviously know they can't win. But anyway, so I'm going to go to Crystal and Ed Sager on Breaking Points, where I'm a premium subscriber proudly, and let them, we're going to hear their analysis about the ridiculous thing Paul Begala has to say, where he is saying the problem is actually not that Joe Biden, et cetera, aren't getting anything done. It's your fault, my fault. It's the followers.
We wanted to start with a rather noteworthy moment from Paul Begala on CNN, where he analyzes the real problem for the Democratic Party. Let's take a listen. Paul, let me start with you and the words of the daughter-in-law of Martin Luther King Jr., Andrea Waters King. This is what she told Politico, quote, "What we have seen with President Biden is what happens when he puts the full force and power behind an issue like infrastructure. What we want to see is that same power and passion being put behind voting rights." Do you think that's fair criticism? Did President Biden put more effort into getting infrastructure passed, for example?
Well, he got infrastructure passed, and that's a good thing because success can breed success. He is putting the full force of the presidency behind it. I think the problem for the Democrats right now is not that they have bad leaders. They have bad followers, okay?
Think about that. It's not that the leadership is bad. It's that the followers are bad. Code, blame the voters.
I read the most amazing essay today from Andy Young. Andy is former mayor of Atlanta, former UN ambassador, and more importantly, probably the closest confidant and aide to Dr. King. He told the story. December of 1964, Andy Young and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. go to see Lyndon Johnson to push him for a Voting Rights Act. Johnson says, "I can't do it. I used all my power to get the Civil Rights Act done last year. I don't have the power to push Congress any further on voting rights." As they left the White House, Andy Young's words, he said, I asked Dr. King what he thought. He said, "I think we got to go get the president some power." And so you know what they did? They organized, these are Andy Young's words, "We mobilized the churches, the universities, the labor unions, the business community, a coalition of people of goodwill." In other words, those of us who want to save voting rights, we need to get to work. I do think Biden is putting everything behind this, but he needs better followers. So he needs all of us in the game as well.
I remember.
We need better followers.
The problem isn't Democrats' leaders. It's that they have bad followers. So for those keeping track at home, you'll remember Paul Begala and James Carville. They were famously the, like, "Is the economy stupid?"
Yeah.
Guys, now they're the "It's you stupid." Mm-hmm. Apparently that is their approach.
And
I have to say, this sentiment is not just with Paul Begala. This is the dominant sentiment within the elites of the Democratic Party. It's something that Barack Obama says a little bit more eloquently, yes. But he tends to be like, you know, what happens when you all fail to show up for us is then we get these Republicans in, and then that's really bad. So even the fact that we disappointed you means you still got to show up for us. And is this attitude of total contempt for apparently like 90% of the country that is a big part of the reason that the Democrats are in the terrible straits that they ultimately are? I mean, it started with Hillary Clinton and her basket of deplorables, which apparently was about just a segment of the Trump base, right? Then that quickly expanded to include anyone who voted for Donald Trump is evil and bad and wrong, etc. Well, now it's just the whole country that is unworthy of the wonderful, enlightened Democratic Party, according to Paul Begala. And one more thing that I will say on this, whatever you thought of the George Floyd protest, there it is, undeniable that we just had the largest protest movement in history. So to be like, "Wait, why are you all just sitting on your butts and not doing anything?" is just absurdly insane, given that the history that we've lived here just in the past couple of years.
I think that's a good point. And it's a big sentiment which dominates the very top of the party. And the disconnect is one which is just so astronomical. You know, I think it was yesterday, you and I were talking in the premium discussion post your radar about Democratic donors. But I think this is an important discussion for everybody to hear as well. I was just looking at some of the behind the scenes news. And yesterday, Chuck Schumer held a meeting with like the ultra rich Democratic Party donors. Mm. And they were like, you got to do something on voting rights, Chuck. Like, this, and this. Once again, you think what you want about voting rights. But why exactly is the entire country's national political elite focused on voting rights and the filibuster reform when the economy is the number one issue with gas prices for all Americans, second to COVID? Neither of those things are being talked here at the top. Well, the party's ultra-rich. They're doing fine. Not just fine, they're richer than ever. They are identity politics-obsessed people who, this is their, like, crowning achievement. And who does the political establishment work for? I really have come to believe that the Democratic Party donor base is actually more out of step with its own base and pretty much the entire country than any donor base that exists out there. And it's a very detrimental thing. These are the tech billionaires. These are the Wall Street billionaires. These are people in Hollywood. I mean, they run our society, but they're also running one of these major parties. And the key to understand about this is not the followers. The followers aren't the problem. It is the leaders and, yes, the funders. And the people are revolting, Crystal. Go ahead and put this up there on the screen, which is that we now have the latest Wall Street Journal poll here. Hispanic voters are now evenly split between parties. Republicans have made rapid gains amongst a crucial voting demographic that has looked at Democrats. But just go ahead and look at that level of support here. We're talking about 45% Trump and 46% Biden for if the 2024 election were held today for whom Hispanics would vote. That's all adults. Look at men. It's 56%. 56. So the only thing that really evens it out is the disparate treatment between Hispanic men and Hispanic women. But that is just a stunning figure. And then actually, in terms of the generic ballot, which candidate you would support for Congress, the GOP is coming out on top at 44 to 41, Crystal. I've never seen anything like this
before. I mean, we should say, I do want to put in the caveat that it's a pretty small sample size. This was 1,500 registered voters, but only 165 Hispanic voters.
Okay.
And there is a margin of error of 8 points. However, this tracks with other data that we've seen. The Glenn Youngkin victory. Again, 50-50. Small sample size in terms of what they were able to glean from the Hispanic electorate, but the numbers come out very similarly. Of course, we saw, and this we had a lot of numbers for, how much of a significant shift there was among Hispanic voters towards Trump in the last election. So it's a small sample size. Take it with a grain of salt. But because it does match up with other trends that we've seen, I think people should really take it seriously here. And to go back to the point about, you know, Paul Begala and the leaders versus the followers, I think you're exactly right when you say the problem with the Democratic Party is not the followers. In fact, the problem with the country isn't the American people.
It's not, no.
It's the people who are here in Washington who run the show. It's the donor class. It's the elites who control Wall Street and corporate America. They're the ones who are the radicals, and they are the ones who are standing in the way of an agenda that could be wildly popular. Put party labels aside. We're about to cover this in the next block. The stock ban. It's over 70% of the country is like, of course members of Congress shouldn't be engaging in insider trading. Like, obviously, we're basically all in agreement on that. We're in agreement on paid sick leave. We're in agreement on prescription drug price reform. We're in agreement on affordable care. And yes, Medicare for All continues to be pretty darn popular. There is a popular consensus agenda out there waiting to be implemented that the American people are totally on board with. $15 minimum wage, another great example. Easy majority right there. What is blocking this progress? It is not the followers. It is certainly not the base of the Democratic Party. It's people like Paul Begala and his buddies here in Washington that prevent any sort of change from happening. And they want you to believe that it's the followers, that it's the American people. They're too dumb. They're too racist. They're too this. They're too that. But actually, if we just picked random names out of the telephone book to sit in Congress and these people's chairs, I am 100% certain we would get way better results than what we're ultimately getting. And by the way, this attitude, again, from Begala, which comes from a lot of the Democratic elites, and people are not stupid, they see it and they feel it, has translated into dismal approval ratings for Joe Biden, who has now got to be counted as one of the least effectual presidents in our lifetimes. Let's go ahead and put this up on the screen. From Quinnipiac, Biden's approval rating in this one poll drops to a new low of 33%. Okay? Do you know what Donald Trump's lowest approval rating was his entire presidency?
35.
34.
There we go.
Biden now has a lower approval. Now, listen, again, it's one poll. I looked at the average of polls on Real Clear Politics. Right now, his approval is rating about 42 to 52. He's 10 points underwater. But this is a dire sign of how badly this presidency has gone. We talked yesterday about how many voters feel like Democrats and Joe Biden are not focused on their concerns. And I don't know how anyone feels like these people are focused on their concerns. What are they even focused on except for, like, making a speech and posturing about voting rights, which they have no plan to actually implement, even if that is your number one issue? Which, by the way, when we look at the polling, number one issues are health care, economy, and climate change. So given that state of affairs, I don't know how anyone feels like these people are really in touch with their concerns, unless your top concern is, like, Lin-Manuel Miranda coming out to celebrate January 6th anniversary.
If they dropped all this voting rights stuff, they spent a month on trying to lower the price of gas, they may not even have to succeed, just try, they would do better in the polls. But look, these people are idiots, and I think that that's the part that we really have to focus on. And just so you guys, you know, have an understanding of how broken the system is, do you know the prospective GOP senator John Sununu, who was the governor of New Hampshire, was considering a run for the Senate. But he gave an interesting interview. Let's go ahead and put this up there on the screen. So here's what he said as to why he did not run. He goes, well, for the most part, they are content, as in the GOP senators, with the speed at which they weren't doing anything. It was clear. We just have to hold the line for 2 years. Okay, so I'm just going to be a roadblock for 2 years? That's not what I do. The governor said that the message from every GOP senator he chatted with, and chatted with most of them, was that they plan to do little more with the majority they are fighting to win this November than obstruct Joe Biden until hopefully 2024 ushers a Republican into the White House. It bothered me that they were okay with that. Sorry, it was Chris Sununu, not John Sununu. But I think it's very important to understand here that the incentives on both sides here appear to be that the Republican Party has no mandate, at least a part of what it's given, than to obstruct. The Democratic Party, I mean, kind of had a mandate. I would say Biden had a mandate on vaccines and on economic recovery. You know, vaccines, he certainly did well. And actually, it's the only area in which he has above 50% approval. It's like 52% on vaccine distribution. Great. In terms of handling the pandemic, like 30. So he failed in terms of his broader mission, but in that one broad way. But on the economy, obviously, that didn't work out. And when you have just such a total, I don't even want to say gridlock, because it almost understates the problem. When you just have such titanic forces, both at the very, very top, not actually working in order to make life better, things are falling apart out there. I mean, no wonder people are angry, you know, social dissatisfaction. The meta-sociological trends are moving in a direction which is terrible. I mean, depression, suicide, the deaths of despair, fentanyl overdose. It's like housing prices are out of control. I'm going to be doing something on that tomorrow. Every facet basic of American life, I said this yesterday, is becoming miserable. And what are they doing? I mean, it's almost like they're responding it by trying to make it more miserable for the everyday population, because the people at the top are doing quite well.
Yeah, I mean, the point of showing that thing from Sununu, who was a top recruit, who actually people were pretty surprised when he took a pass, and that would have been an almost gimme pickup for Republicans in the Senate, because he is popular in the state of New Hampshire, which is, you know, it's a swing state, it's a tough state for the Republicans to ultimately win. The reason to show that is to say it's utterly pathetic you all are losing to these people. Like, they're upfront about the fact that they literally don't stand for anything, that they're not, what is the agenda that they're running on?
Nothing.
In the side, they're literally upfront saying, we don't have an agenda, we're just not them. And they are very likely to win, not just a majority, but it's possible that if things continue to go their way, they'll win the largest majority in a century. Now, flip that around to last year. about this time, a little bit before this time, when Democrats had a very significant partisan advantage in terms of party identification. Well, what were they talking about relentlessly then? Vaccine distribution and checks.
Yeah.
Checks, direct stimulus checks, something that was measurable, something that they were dramatically on the right side of, something where the Republican Party looked completely on a step with the American people. Well, there are a ton of issues that I just named where you still have that position where you could be on the right side here, on the 80% or 70% side of public support and put Republicans in a tough spot, but you're not doing that. You're not even coming close to doing that. It's insane. And of course, now they've basically like given up on any kind of an economic agenda. It's more comfortable for them. And it's like what the donor class wants to hear for them to sort of posture on voting rights, something else that they have no chance, no plan to ultimately get through. And so ultimately, you know, these disastrous numbers that are coming out, it's not the fault of your followers. It's the fault of you guys. And so placing blame anywhere else is just absolutely absurd.
Yeah.
So I think I've said it before, but if I didn't, I'll say it again. Just like the donors by politicians legally in America, because, you know, it's organized bribery, it's money, it's speech. And the person with the most money gets to speak the most, and politicians hear money. Money talks. You know, who doesn't have disposable income? People who probably don't make $30,000 a year, which is right at $15 an hour. They probably don't have a lot of money to be giving to politicians. So, when I go out and I vote for people, which I do regularly, believe it or not, I don't vote for you to be a potted plant. I actually vote because I want to get something out of it. A lot of times I have been forced to vote for harm reduction. Who is going to do the least amount of harmful things? And it feels like a devil's bargain. But I say all this just to say, if people vote for you, maybe, just maybe, you'll keep their votes if you actually start to deliver and give them materially something that they could actually feel in their actual lives. Then they wouldn't have to be so involved and so wrapped up in all these culture fights. To be flat honest, most of the culture war stuff happens because there actually isn't anything happening to make anybody's life any better. So they argue over the parsley on the plate instead of dealing with the meat and the potatoes. So give people material goods and resources. Give them infrastructure that isn't dilapidated and falling apart. Give them things that jobs that allow them to work with dignity and decency, and just maybe, maybe your numbers will start to improve. Just maybe you'll start to have good followers. Just maybe you won't have these polls that I'm looking at where Americans think a civil war is inevitable. Maybe if you start delivering material goods to the people, maybe the country will start to actually think that the people in power are actually decent. But I'll won't be holding my breath for that to happen. I go back to what Paul Begala used to say when he used to be hanging out with James Carville. It's the economy. That's what it is. If people don't feel like they're going anywhere in life, they're not going to want to go out and vote. If they don't feel like there's a reason, they're not going to do it. If they don't feel like their life has gotten any better, they're not going to do it. We used to have a question. When you were going for re-election, they would ask you to ask yourself a question. Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? And I think what is sad is most people are worse off today than they were 4 years ago, 8 years ago, 12 years ago, 16 years ago, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. People are not having children because they cannot afford children. They're not buying houses because they cannot afford houses. We are in the forever rent class. The student loan industry has actually started to garnish people's Social Security because that is how bad it was. It got so ridiculous that people who are now able to receive Social Security never paid their student loans. Probably because they didn't have the income to pay the student loans. And now their Social Security benefits, for the record, you can tap into Social Security when you hit 62. So their Social Security benefits are being taken, probably about 25%. Because they never paid off their student loans. And that's something that I say when you get to that point. A 62-year-old person still has student loans they have to be paying off. You have to ask structurally, how are we failing? This is public policy. You look at the policy, you see it doesn't work, you change it. So I got some DeSantis Trump stuff, Supreme Court stuff, and then we're going to end out the show. So the background is simple. People have started to grow a liking to Ron DeSantis in the Republican Party, especially the D.C. people who like Donald Trump but want somebody a bit more polished. Ron DeSantis fits the profile because he is a Ivy League graduate, comes off as particularly smart, knows how to play the media, doesn't normally talk in a normal speaking language, so he can talk well and he speaks and nobody says, oh my goodness, this guy's a buffoon. And he is somewhat caught, are definitely caught the attention of former President Donald Trump, and things have heated up. Let's just say it.
Do you reconsider your push for it, or what's your view now on the vaccine in general?
Well, I've taken it. I've had the booster. Many politicians, I watched a couple of politicians be interviewed, and one of the questions was, did you get the booster? Because they had the vaccine. And they're answering it like, in other words, the answer is yes, but they don't want to say it. Because they're gutless, got to say it. Whether you had it or not, say it. But the fact is that I think the vaccine has saved tens of millions of people throughout the world. I have had absolutely no side effects. I've had it like other people have had it, nothing special. I've had it.
So Donald Trump is referring to an interview Ron DeSantis gave where he would not say whether he took the booster shot or not. And so Donald Trump calls him gutless. And in the state of Florida, where Donald Trump currently lives as well. So DeSantis fires back, responds the next day on a podcast saying he is disappointed in himself because he did not oppose quickly, and this was the important language, the Trump-mandated lockdowns. So then, almost the very same day, Trump kind of hits DeSantis as like dull DeSantis, and then a bunch of, let's just say, Trump loyalists, there is a thing that comes out in the New York Times. Who is the king of Florida as tensions rise between Trump and a former acolyte? A spat over COVID has exposed frictions between the former president and a rising GOP governor unwilling to curb his ambitions. For months, former President Donald J. Trump has been grumping quietly to friends and visitors to his Palm Beach mansion about a rival Republican power center in another Florida mansion some 400 miles to the north. Governor Ron DeSantis and Trump believes he put on the map he has been acting far less like an acolyte and more like a future competitor. President Trump complains with his stock rising fast in the party, the governor has conspicuously refrained from saying he would stand aside if President Trump decided to run for the Republican nomination again for president in 2024. These magic words Trump has said to several associates and advisors. That long-stewing resentment burst into public view recently in a dispute over the seemingly unrelated topic of COVID policies. After Mr. DeSantis refused to reveal his full COVID vaccination history, the former president publicly acknowledged he had received a booster. Last week, he seemed to swipe at DeSantis by blasting as gutless politician who dodged the question out of fear of blowback from vaccine skeptics. Mr. DeSantis shot back on Friday, criticizing Trump's early handling of the pandemic, saying he regretted not being more vocal on his complaint. Now, the back and forth exposed how far Republicans have shifted to the right on coronavirus politics. The doubts Trump amplified about public health expertise have only spurlanced since he left office. Now, his defense of vaccines, even if often subdued, and almost always with the caveat in the same breath that he opposes mandates, has put him uncharacteristically out of step with hardline elements of his own party's base and provided an opening for a rival. But that is where Mr. DeSantis, a once loyal member of the Trump court wielding the knife, made the tension about much more. At its core, despite amounts to the stand and for a broader challenge confronting Republicans at the onset of the midterm elections, they are led by the defeated former president who demands total fealty, brooks no criticism, and determines to sniff out and then snuff out any threat to his control over the Republican Party. That includes the 43-year-old Ron DeSantis, who has told friends he believes Trump's expectations that he bend the knee is asking too much. That refusal has set up a generational clash and a test of loyalty in the de facto capital of today's GOP, one watched by Republicans elsewhere who have risen to power on Donald Trump's coattails. Now, already party figures are attempting to calm matters. Quote, they are the two most important leaders in the Republican Party, said Brian Bollard, a longtime Florida lobbyist with connections to both men, predicting Mr. Trump and Mr. DeSantis will be personal political friends the rest of their careers. Trump's aides have also tried to tamp down questions about the former president's frustrations so as to not elevate Mr. DeSantis. Now, still, Trump has made no secrets of his preparations for a third run for the White House. And while Mr. DeSantis, who is up for re-election this year, has not declared his plans, he is widely believed to be eyeing the presidency. So Trump and his aides are mindful of Republican increasingly public fatigue with the drama that trails President Trump. The former president's false claims about the 2020 election, which Mr. DeSantis has not challenged, and his role in the events leading up to January 6th, Capitol riots have some Republicans looking for a fresh start. Now, DeSantis is often the first name Republicans cite as a possible Trump-style contender, not named Donald Trump. DeSantis will be formidable 2024 candidate in the Trump lane should Trump not run, said Dan Elbert, a Republican donor. He's Trump, but a little smarter, more disciplined, and brisk without being too brisk. So, notably, Trump, a longtime student of charisma and mass appeal, as well as an avid reader of polling, has refrained so far from publicly attacking DeSantis, who is a distant but potent second to him in the polls on the 2024 GOP field. His restraint is a break from the mockery and bullying he often uses to attack Republicans he perceives as vulnerable. Trump made no reference to the governor at a rally in Arizona on Saturday. DeSantis has $70 million in the bank for his re-election war chest. He stocked with help from the Republican rank and file donor class alike. He has raised his profile in the same spaces Trump once dominated. The governor is also unambiguous on Fox News, where he is routinely met with the sort of softballs that have routinely were once arched toward President Trump. And he frequently mixes the well-tamed Republican donor community near the former president's winter home in South Florida. It was not always this way. Mr. DeSantis was actually a little-known Florida congressman in 2017, where Trump, who was then the president, spotted him on television and took a keen interest. DeSantis, an Ivy League educated military veteran and smooth-talking defender of the new president, was exactly what President Trump liked in politicians. It wasn't long before Trump blessed DeSantis' bid for governor and sent his staff to help him, lifting the lawmaker to a victory over a better-known rival for the party's nomination, and that was, of course, Andrew Gillum. Now, DeSantis survived general election and often governed in a style that mirrors his patron, slashing at the left and scrapping with the news media, but that alone doesn't placate to Trump. As with other Republicans, he has endorsed the former president, appears to take a kind of ownership interest in DeSantis, and he believes that he is owed dividends and deference. "Look, I helped Ron DeSantis at a level that nobody's ever seen before," Trump said in an interview for a forthcoming book, Insurgency, on the rightward shift to the Republican Party, by the New York Times reporter Jeffrey W. Peters. Trump said he believed DeSantis didn't have a chance of winning without his help. The former president's expectations of deference from DeSantis is a reminder to other Republicans that Trump's endorsement actually come with the price, a demand that could prove particularly consequential should he run again and have a stable of Republicans lawmakers in his debt. At times, President Trump has sought to kindle his relationship with DeSantis, and he suggests the governor would be a strong choice for vice president. Similar courtship has helped with his defense from potential rivals, but DeSantis has not relented. "I wonder why the guy won't say he won't run against me," Trump has said to several associates and advisors who spoke on the condition of anonymity, and he describes to in private conversations. Trump began the recent counter-attempts by attacking the governor's refusal to acknowledge whether he had received the COVID-19 booster shot. "The answer is yes, but they won't say it because they're gutless," Trump said in a television interview, referring to only politicians, but clearly alluding to DeSantis. "You got to say it. Whether you had it or not, just say it." DeSantis' response came on Friday in an interview on the conservative podcast Ruthless, speaking in front of a person's audience near St. Petersburg, Florida. The governor said one of the biggest regrets was not wrongfully opposing Trump's call for lockdowns when the coronavirus first began. "Knowing now what I know is that what was a threat earlier, I would have been much louder," DeSantis said. The governor said he had been telling Trump stop the flights from China, but argued he never thought in the earlier March of 2020 that the virus would lead to locking down the country. DeSantis then moved quickly to place blame on Anthony Fauci, who advised Trump on the country's COVID response, a much safer target with conservatives. The former president did not immediately respond. Without a Twitter account, his hair-trigger retorts had become less frequent. A spokesman for Trump also did not respond to requests to comment. An advisor to DeSantis declined to comment as well. DeSantis, however, has touched on a delicate issue on the few Mr. Trump is left of his party's hardliners to the efficacy of the vaccine and the deference to public health experts' advice to how Trump spread the virus. Trump has begun blasting warning shots at DeSantis over aspiring to Republican, signaling he intends to defend the vaccines his administration helps to develop. In an interview with Candace Owens, a right-wing media personality, the former president said the vaccines work and dismiss conspiracy theories. "People aren't dying when they take the vaccines," he says. Now, DeSantis, though, has been much more eager to focus on his resistance to COVID-19 restrictions, past and present, than to make a robust case for vaccination and booster shots. Notably, at a rally on Saturday, Trump did not promote vaccines and criticized so-called lockdowns. Trump's loudest antagonists are likely to continue to stoke the tensions between the two men. For example, Ann Coulter, the conservative commentator who has fallen out with the former president, delighted in the dust-up this week. Trump is demanding to know DeSantis' booster status, and I can now reveal it, Ms. Coulter wrote on Twitter. He was a loyal booster when Trump ran in 2016, but then he learned our president was a liar and a con man whose grift was permanent. That's funny. Ann Coulter calling somebody a liar and a con is hilarious. But anyway, in an email, Ms. Coulter herself, a part-time Florida resident, put a finer point. Makes DeSantis rise on selling for former President Trump is done, she wrote. You guys stop obsessing over him. So that is that. The funny thing is, they interviewed Donald Trump after Ron DeSantis won in Florida. Donald Trump totally believes that he is the only reason DeSantis won. Donald Trump openly said Ron DeSantis was a nobody. And when he came in, Trump came in and DeSantis won by 35 points. So Trump totally believes he can quash DeSantis. So let me go ahead and spill the beans here. Ron DeSantis has been hanging around a lot of people that have been boosting his head and making him believe that he would actually beat Donald Trump in a primary. Let me go ahead and make a prediction. Ron DeSantis would not beat Donald Trump in a primary. Donald Trump has already beaten Ron DeSantis types in a primary. Ron DeSantis is Ted Cruz. Ron DeSantis is Chris Christie. Ron DeSantis is Rand Paul. Ron DeSantis is Newt Gingrich, etc., etc., etc. Donald Trump has already beaten those people. Ron DeSantis is Herman Cain. Donald Trump has beat already all those types of Republicans. A former congressman or a senator or whatever who turns governor. Ron DeSantis is a politician and Donald Trump eats politicians alive. You know why? Because Donald Trump's going to say exactly what he thinks and that's what people like. Because Ron DeSantis won't even say, hey, I didn't take the booster. He has to say, I don't like when people ask me that. And Donald Trump is going to be on stage and he'll say, say it, Ron. Say it. What are you so afraid for? Do you think they work? I heard your wife is going through chemo. Did your wife take the vaccines? You know, why are you so ashamed? And Ron DeSantis is going to act like every single last one of them acted when they tried to come up with the weight of the punches that Donald Trump is going to throw at them. Because Donald Trump does not just punch high, he punches low, and he will constantly respond to everything, everywhere, at all times. And I don't think that Ron DeSantis is actually ready for that type of smoke. People in D.C. like Ron DeSantis because he comes from there. But when everybody knows, we saw it. 17 people ran in the Republican primary, so, and every politician that everybody loved when they got on that stage with Donald Trump, it doesn't go how they think it's going to go. He's unhinged, and they have no idea what to do with it. Hillary Clinton tried, she couldn't do it. Joe Biden tried, couldn't do it. Donald Trump does very different things to politicians once he gets them in these types of normal confrontations. And when it comes to that very particular issue of the vaccines, it's very, very important to remember, Trump is a baby boomer. 95% of baby boomers, 95% of baby boomers are vaccinated. That is who is going to vote in the primaries, the boomers. So I do not think there is an actual path for Ron DeSantis to beat Donald Trump in a Republican primary. Just don't see it happening. I'm going to say something that should be obvious. President Trump has a better read on what the Republican base wants than all the pollsters will actually tell you. He has a better read on what Republican voters want, what the base wants, more than the professional politicians. He has a better read on what the elderly population, so 65 and up, want than most of the people who are call themselves professional political theatricians. He knows better because he is them. So I don't see him beating him. I think the only reason that this has even become a topic is because of stories like the one I'm going to talk about now. We actually have polling on this. There was just a poll where they put Donald Trump next to Joe Biden. Again, Donald Trump and Joe Biden were tied. They did a poll with Joe Biden and Ron DeSantis. Ron DeSantis was actually trailing Joe Biden by 7 points. That pretty much says all that I think should be said about this. If Donald Trump runs for re-election, he is going to win the Republican primary.
Well, it's an extraordinary rebuke of the former president. First of all, this is just the back of his hand. It's just a one paragraph opinion with only one dissent. All three Trump appointees voting with the majority. Plus, you remember when this was argued, there was a lot of controversy over who gets to exert executive privilege. Is it only the incumbent president, or can a former president assert executive privilege? The court said it doesn't matter, because even if Trump had been the president asserting executive privilege here, he still would have lost the case. So it is a thoroughgoing repudiation of his legal position, and in further years, this will strengthen Congress's hand in investigating the executive branch, even well into the future.
Were you surprised that Justice Clarence Thomas dissented?
Not at all. What surprised me is that there were not more of the conservatives who dissented. Clarence Thomas is the most right-wing member of the Supreme Court. He is the farthest from the center of the court, at least on the right side. And what surprised me is that Neil Gorsuch didn't dissent, because they are usually in tandem on almost every issue.
Maggie, do you have any sense from sources what information these documents are likely to contain? I mean, Jessica and I was talking about call logs, movements, but it's not like the former president, you know, is on email and TikTok and Twitter. Well, he was on Twitter at the time, you know, a lot, but you know, he's not somebody who communicates with devices directly.
Now, not only, Anderson, does he not communicate directly in terms of, you know, text or email, you know, if he uses text in responses at all. I know he receives text, and that could be interesting to people, but he also uses aides' phones to make phone calls. He doesn't always use his own phones. He doesn't always use his own cell. He doesn't always use the White House phone into his office, what was his office. So it's not going to be that complete a picture. This has been very closely held about what is actually in these documents. I think that it might end up being that there's less there than people are hoping, but I agree with Jeffrey that what this means is it is not just a rebuke of the former president, but it's a rebuke of this approach of trying to slow everything down with this really broad scale lack of cooperation with this committee, basically just saying we're not going to acknowledge subpoenas over and over and over by any number of people.
So what that was about was this, the Supreme Court's refusal to block the release of Trump's White House documents to the House January 6th committee. It represents a huge defeat for the ex-president, and is a frantic effort to cover up the 2021 attempt at maintaining power. So the major blow is yet another instance of the courts rebuking the former president's attempt to use them for his own political gain. And it will allow the committee to go even deeper inside his West Wing and understand what was going on before and during the mob attack on the U.S. Capitol. It is also likely to be viewed by the former president as a betrayal by the court's conservative majority, which he submitted with 3 picks to the top bench, whom he saw as legal insurance policy as he continually sought to bend governing institutions to his will and to avoid accountability. Now, this decision means that the 700 documents, including schedules, speeches, and call logs, and 3 pages of handwritten notes from the White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows can be transferred from the National Archives to the House Committee as processes that were already underway Wednesday evening. Now, Liz Cheney and Wyoming Republican welcomed the court decisions as a victory for the rule of law and American democracy and vowed to uncover all the facts about the violence of January 6th and its causes. Trump has mounted an intense effort to avoid the scrutiny and had already lost cases in the district and in appellate courts as part of a broad campaign to obstruct the committee, which he included expensive executive privilege claims by ex-aides, even some like the populist political guru Steve Bannon. So who were not even serving as White House officials at the time of the January 6th Capitol riot. Another committee member, Rep. Zoe Longfren, said to CNN's Aaron Burnett out front that the Supreme Court ruling was a very big deal of getting the truth out. We're going to get these documents and we're going to go through them and help piece together, the California Democrats said. The case came together after Republicans and President Joe Biden declined to support Trump's attempt to prevent to hand over the documents, arguing the attack on the Capitol was such an affront to the Constitution that it must be investigated. The Supreme Court did not rule on key legal questions of what happens when this dispute between a current and former president's scope of executive privilege, a concept meant to assure that advice to a commander-in-chief from subordinates can stay private, but it allowed to stand a ruling by an appellate court that found Trump had not demonstrated that his concerns for the executive branch confidentiality should override the profound interest in disclosure cited by the Biden administration. Now, Trump's lawyers had asked the Supreme Court for a full review of this case, citing important issues that privilege that reverberate through history, but the committee made a request for an expedient review just before Christmas, citing the urgency of its investigation. Ruling closes off of any avenue of Trump's legal strategy running out the clock of the investigations before November's midterm elections and possible GOP takeover of the House. Now, the Supreme Court's ruling will play into an intense debate over efforts by former Trump aides to assert executive privilege in order to avoid testifying to the committee. Some of those claims are especially unusual, according to many legal experts, frivolous because they cover conversations between officials and outsiders rather than the president. So the ruling, in which only conservative Justice Clarence Thomas signaled dissent, offers a new mark of legitimacy to the select committee and made claims by pro-Trump Republicans that it is illegally constituted witch hunt, despite being voted into being by the House. It also boosts committee's races against time and tries to complete its work before the possible Republican majority shuts it down. Now, the net has significantly tightened around the former president's neck in recent weeks. And as a civil matter, the state of New York and the attorney general there is going after Trump and his family because she is alleging, to the Department of Justice is alleging, that they fraudulently applied for several loans and grants, etc., by deflating the value of properties when they wanted to lower their tax burden and increasing them when they wanted to get certain loans, etc. So that is why I think that the people in control of the funds, the major donors in D.C. for a lot of the mainstream national Republicans, are looking toward somebody like Ron DeSantis in the hopes that they don't have to go to battle with Trump, who is suffering from death by a thousand cuts. And because he does not have Twitter and Facebook and the sizable audience that he used to have, is right now unable to defend himself. Hopefully the audio is good on this show. I'm recording from a remote location while I am looking for new housing. So we'll try to keep the show running. Any questions you have about any of these topics or anything else you find interesting, you can always find me on the Facebook page, The Daryl McClain Show, or the Twitter, The Daryl McClain Show, or the Instagram, The Daryl McClain Show. Thank you, and I will see you on the next episode and reflect on what our quote of the day was. Okay, I gave you several MLK quotes that I thought were worthwhile, and I'm going to leave with two little clips, and have a good
one. You that produce me, he's one of the great moments in the tradition of a grand people who, in the face of terror and trauma and stigma, was able to generate levels of love and vision and unbelievable high-quality service to the least of these. He is a Christian minister, first and foremost. That is his calling. And what I thought is very important, you and I know that Brother Martin gets deodorized every January. He gets sanitized and sterilized every January.
Santa Clausified.
Yeah, they Santa Clausified it, Brother.
Turn him into
an old man with smile toys in his bag, handing out gifts. Everybody got a smile on their face, and the FBI is saying, he's the most dangerous man in America. And other black leaders are saying, when they're trying to organize poor people and critiques of Vietnam put forward with such power, he's now betraying the movement. He's un-American. He's a traitor to the country and so forth. And so what does Martin do? He said, you never knew me. You never knew me. I'm called to love babies in Vietnam. Babies in Appalachia, babies in South Side of Chicago, babies in Harlem, babies in Ethiopia. I'm a Christian minister. For me, justice is what love looks like in public, just like tenderness is what love feels like in private. That's Martin King. But there's no Martin without L. Baker, without Stokely Carmichael, without so many of the Freedom, Diane Nash. We can go on and on. Fannie Lou Hamer.
Talk a little bit for a moment about the Santa Clausification with respect to African Americans, because I think that part of what you're describing is a kind of historical amnesia for the fact that Dr. King was not always well loved within the black community. And you cite a pretty remarkable poll from late in his life that says that 55% of African Americans did not support Dr. King on Vietnam and ending poverty. And I think it was the ending poverty part that caught me off guard.
Yes, no, it's true, and it's very sad. You got 72% of Americans across the board, all colors, and 55% of black people disapproving of Martin. You remember what Whitney Young said to Brother Martin in terms of, you sitting back to the black freedom movement, Martin looked at him and said, oh, what you say may get you money from corporation, but it won't get you a foothold in the kingdom of truth. Typical intra-struggle against black, within black leadership over where to go. See, Martin was saying, corporation's not going to dictate what my conscience actually is.
Right. I know the difference between white, right, wrong.
Absolutely. And big money and all of the thrills and the assets to power is not going to determine what I say. You see, Martin was like John Coltrane. Man, he could have been doing my favorite things for the rest of his career and been a multi-millionaire. He brings in, what are you doing? Being true to himself. Well, you see, this is, to me, the real standard of what we need in this present moment. And so we got a lot of black people, for example, who say they love Martin Luther King Jr. and they talk about speaking truth to power, but they don't want to speak truth to the present power. You see what I mean? Yeah, they want to become accommodation is resonant, Brother Martin. And there's nothing wrong with being accommodationist if you're honest about it and acknowledge what its limitations are. But don't lie to yourself.
Right.
And acting as if you're so progressive and prophetic when you're really just a cheerleader and a bootlicker. I mean, you got to be honest and candid about these things.
Last Sunday, more than 8,000 of us started on a mighty walk from Selma, Alabama. We have walked through desolate valleys and across trying hills. We have walked on meandering highways and rested our bodies on rocky byways. Some of our faces are burned from the outpourings of the sweltering sun. Some have literally slept in the mud. We have been drenched by the rain. Our bodies are tired. Our feet are somewhat sore. But today, as I stand before you and think back over that great march, I can say, as Sister Paula said, 70-year-old Negro woman who lived in this community during the bus boycott, and one day she was asked while walking, she didn't want to ride, and when she answered no, the person said, "Well, aren't you tired?" With her ungrammatical profundity, she said, "My feet is tired, but my soul is rested."
That's right.
And in a real sense, this afternoon, we can say that our feet are tired,
yes,
but our souls are rested. They told us we wouldn't get here. Now were those who said that we would get here only over that dead body.
Well, I said,
yeah. All the world today knows that we are here and we are standing before the forces of power in the state of Alabama saying we ain't gonna let nobody turn us around. Now, it is not an accident. One of the great marches of American history should terminate in Montgomery, Alabama.
Yes, sir.
Just 10 years ago in this very city, a new philosophy was born of the Negro struggle. Montgomery was the first city in the South in which the entire Negro community united and squarely faced its age-old oppressor.
Yes, sir. Well,
out of its struggle, more than bus segregation was won. A new idea, more powerful than guns or clubs, was born. Negroes took it and carried it across the South in epic battle.
Yes, sir.
That electrified the nation and the world. Yet strangely, the climatic conflicts always were fought and won on Alabama soil. After Montgomery's heroic confrontations loomed up in Mississippi, Arkansas, Georgia, and elsewhere. But not until the colossus of segregation was challenged in Birmingham did the conscience of America begin to bleed. White America was profoundly aroused by Birmingham because it witnessed a whole community of Negroes facing terror and brutality with majestic sadistic scorn and heroic courage.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. Of course, if you want to support the show, you can do so by going to www.patreon.com and getting a membership for as little as $3 a month. Again, that's www.patreon.com/The Darrell McLean Show. The Darrell McLean Show is fully listener-supported, independent media that won't lead you to tribalism. Get a membership and support independent media at www.patreon.com/The Darrell McLean Show.